In our previous lecture, we looked at the Supreme Court's landmark rulings in the area of criminal law. We saw that the Bill of Rights includes four amendments that were designed to protect the rights of criminal defendants. These amendments provide a code of criminal procedure, beginning with the investigation of crime through arrest, trial, and sentencing. We examined cases that dealt with search and seizure, the right to counsel, and protections against self-incrimination. Under the leadership of Chief Justice Earl Warren, the court expanded the rights of defendants and applied the criminal law provisions of the Bill of Rights to the states. These rulings, particularly the famous Miranda case in 1966, provoke controversy and debate that continues today. In this lecture, we're going to conclude our discussion of the Warren Court and look at other cases that also provoke controversy and debate. We'll begin with brief sketches of the justices who served with Chief Justice Warren, particularly those who joined the court between his appointment in 1953 and his retirement in 1969. We'll then discuss several of the Warren Court's landmark rulings in the areas of political representation, civil rights enforcement, and free speech. This lecture will also set the stage for our discussion in following lectures of the court under Warren's successor, Chief Justice Warren Burger. We've already been introduced to the eight justices who sat on the court when Earl Warren took his seat in 1953. Five of those justices have been named by President Franklin D. Roosevelt: Hugo Black, Stanley Reed, Felix Frankfurter, William O. Douglas, and Robert Jackson. These were the New Deal justices, who were all then in their 40s and early 50s when they joined the court. President Harry Truman had picked the other three justices, Harold Burton, Tom Clark, and Sherman Minton. The court had aged since Roosevelt had carried out his pledge to add new blood to the bench. Warren himself was 62 when he became Chief Justice, which was the average age of the other eight justices as well. These were not the nine old men of the 1930s, and the court had none of the judicial reactionaries who had frustrated Roosevelt's New Deal programs. It's fair to say the court in 1953 was neither liberal nor conservative. On some issues, such as civil rights, the justices stood together, most notably in the cases that struck down school segregation. On other issues, such as the prosecution of Communist Party leaders, the court's majority took a restrictive position on First Amendment rights. I think it's accurate to characterize the court as a moderate institution when Earl Warren became the Chief Justice. During the first 5 years of Warren's tenure, four justices left the court through death and retirement. President Dwight Eisenhower, who was elected as a moderate Republican, filled all these empty seats on the bench. Justice Robert Jackson died in 1954 and was replaced by John Marshall Harlan. We've already met Harlan, who had been a Wall Street lawyer for 20 years before he joined the court. Harlan took a generally conservative position on most issues, although he supported First Amendment rights in many cases. But Eisenhower's next appointment added a firmly liberal voice to the court. Justice Sherman Minton retired in October of 1956, just 1 month before the presidential election, in which Eisenhower sought a second term in the White House. The president surprised many people by naming William J. Brennan to replace Minton. Electoral politics played a role in this choice. Brennan was a highly respected judge on the New Jersey Supreme Court, and his legal abilities were beyond question. But he was also a Democrat and a Catholic from a northern state, and Eisenhower hoped to pick up votes from these groups in his reelection campaign. As it turned out, the president swamped his Democratic opponent, Adlai Stevenson, and hardly needed any votes that Brennan's nomination might swing in the election. There's an amusing story about Brennan's journey to the Supreme Court. Herbert Brownell, who was Eisenhower's attorney general, called Brennan one night in New Jersey and asked him to come to Washington the next morning. Brennan thought Brownell wanted his advice on court reform. This was an issue the two men had recently discussed at a judicial conference. Brownell later said that when he offered Brennan the Supreme Court position, "I never heard a man say yes so fast." It's fair to say that Brennan had a greater impact on the Supreme Court than any other justice in the 20th century. His tenure spanned 34 years, from 1956 until his retirement in 1990. During these years, Brennan wrote dozens of landmark opinions, which reflected his bedrock commitment to human dignity as a guiding principle. In one case, Brennan upheld the right of John Kelly, a disabled welfare recipient, to receive a hearing before officials cut off his benefits. Brennan put the broader issue in these words: "From its founding, the nation's basic commitment has been to foster the dignity and well-being of all persons within its borders." He absorbed this principle both from his church and his family. Brennan learned the Catholic social gospel from his church's teachings. "Justice demands that the dignity of the human personality be respected," one encyclical stated. Brennan's father was an Irish immigrant who stoked furnaces in a brewery and who fought for his fellow workers as a union leader. On the court, Brennan's personal warmth, his Irish charm, and his legal brilliance made him the leader of the liberal justices. He often persuaded the court's moderate justices and even conservatives to join the majority in many closely divided cases. For almost three decades after Earl Warren left the court, Brennan kept the legacy of the Warren Court alive, protecting many of its landmark decisions from reversal by judicial conservatives. Even his critics paid tribute to Brennan's unflagging devotion to the principles he espoused for so many years. But he didn't win over the president who named him to the court. Someone later asked Eisenhower if he made any mistakes as president. "Yes, two," he replied, "and they are both sitting on the Supreme Court." Eisenhower was referring to Earl Warren and William Brennan. But his biggest mistake in picking justices came in his fourth nomination. Stanley Reed's retirement in 1957 opened a seat that could be filled without political considerations. Eisenhower replaced Reed with Charles Whitaker, who had practiced corporate law in Kansas City for 30 years, and who came to the court after 3 years on the federal appellate bench. Whitaker proved totally unfit for his new job. He developed a paralyzing writer's block and produced no opinions of any significance. Whitaker retired in 1962 as disabled and was rated by scholars as a judicial failure. Eisenhower's fifth and final Supreme Court nomination went to another Midwestern corporate lawyer who also served on the federal appellate bench. Justice Harold Burton retired in 1958 and was replaced by Potter Stewart of Ohio. Stewart had practiced law in Cincinnati after graduating from Yale Law School. He was a friend and political ally of Senator Robert Taft, the Republican Party's conservative leader. But Stewart risked his political future by backing Eisenhower over Taft at the 1952 Republican convention. He was rewarded in 1954 with a federal appellate court position and won respect for well-crafted opinions that stuck to the facts and bowed to precedent. During 23 years on the Supreme Court, Stewart wrote more than 600 opinions, but just one contains a memorable phrase. Writing in a case that reversed an obscenity conviction for showing a French art movie, Stewart put the difficulty of defining hardcore pornography in these words: "I know it when I see it, and the motion picture involved in this case is not that." With the exception of William Brennan, the justices named by President Eisenhower did not shift the court's moderate balance. In fact, Justices Harlan and Whitaker turned the court slightly to the right. What we now call the Warren Court did not really emerge until Presidents John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson added four new justices between 1962 and 1967. Kennedy and Johnson were both Democrats, and they were supported by their party's liberal coalition of black voters, Jews, and labor unions. So it's not surprising that their Supreme Court nominees had close ties with these groups. Kennedy got his first chance to reshape the court when Justice Whitaker retired as disabled in 1962. He named Byron White of Colorado, who was probably the most physically able justice in the court's history. White earned both a Phi Beta Kappa Key and All-American honors in football at the University of Colorado, where he gained the nickname Whizzer for his speed as a running back. He later juggled his studies at Yale Law School with games for the Detroit Lions, and he served as a PT boat skipper during World War II, forming a close friendship with another skipper, Jack Kennedy. After the war and a clerkship with Chief Justice Fred Vinson, White practiced law in Colorado, where he managed Kennedy's presidential campaign in 1960. Kennedy named him as Deputy Attorney General in 1961, and White spent a turbulent year in the Justice Department, stamping out civil rights fires in the Deep South. During 33 years on the court, White consistently supported civil rights, but he took a hardline position in criminal cases, as we saw in the Miranda case. He also opposed abortion rights from the Roe decision in 1973 until his retirement in 1993. President Kennedy pleased both the Jewish community and the labor movement when he named Arthur Goldberg to replace Justice Felix Frankfurter in 1962. Goldberg was general counsel of the Steelworkers Union and had advised Kennedy on labor issues during the 1960 campaign. Frankfurter had served for 23 years, but Goldberg remained on the court for just three. After President Kennedy's assassination in November of 1963, Lyndon Johnson moved from the vice presidency into the White House. Kennedy had sent several hundred American troops to Vietnam, and Johnson inherited what started as a small conflict but soon escalated into a major war. Looking for ways to end the war, Johnson persuaded Goldberg to leave the court and become the United Nations ambassador. Under his deal with Johnson, Goldberg would help to mediate an American exit from Vietnam and then return to the court. But the war ended Johnson's presidency in 1968, and Goldberg returned to law practice. During his brief judicial service, Goldberg had a consistently liberal voting record. Goldberg's departure opened a seat for one of Johnson's closest legal and political advisors, Abe Fortas. A native of Memphis, Tennessee, he became editor-in-chief of the Yale Law Journal and joined Yale's law faculty after his graduation in 1933. Fortas worked in several New Deal agencies and was solicitor of the Interior Department when he met Johnson, who was then a young Texas congressman. Johnson owed his Senate election in 1948 to Fortas, who persuaded the Supreme Court to keep federal judges from looking into Johnson's 87-vote primary victory, which earned him the nickname of Landslide Lyndon. As we saw in our previous lecture, Chief Justice Warren had appointed Fortas to argue for Clarence Gideon in the case that established the right to counsel for criminal defendants. We'll discuss the sordid end to Fortas's brilliant legal and judicial career in our next lecture. But his 3 years on the court were marked by several landmark opinions, one of which we'll discuss very shortly. Johnson made history with his second nominee to the court. Justice Tom Clark retired in 1967, and the president named Thurgood Marshall to replace him. Now, we've looked at Marshall's brilliant record as the NAACP's chief counsel from 1938 to 1961. During those years, he won all but three of the 32 cases he argued before the Supreme Court. President Kennedy named Marshall in 1961 to the Federal Appellate Court in New York, and he resigned from the bench in 1965 when President Johnson offered him the post of Solicitor General in the Justice Department. Marshall became the first black person to hold that position. Several justices had served as Solicitor General before moving to the Supreme Court, and many people assumed that Johnson was grooming Marshall for the court. The president told Marshall that wasn't the case. "You know, this has nothing to do with any Supreme Court appointment," he said when Marshall visited the Oval Office to discuss the job. But in fact, that was the case. "I did not tell Marshall my intentions at this time," Johnson later said, "but I fully intended to eventually appoint him to the court. I believed that a black man had to be appointed to that body." When President Johnson named Marshall to the court, many Southern senators did not relish the prospect of a black man on the high bench. Led by Strom Thurmond of South Carolina, Southern senators grilled Marshall during his confirmation hearings and stalled a vote for more than 2 months. But President Johnson was a former Senate Majority Leader, and he twisted enough arms to secure Marshall's confirmation by a vote of 89-11, with all the nays coming from the Deep South. We'll look at several of Marshall's landmark opinions in later lectures, but his 24 years on the court were marked by more than his written opinions. He brought the perspective of a black American to the court for the first time in its history. "What do they know about Negroes?" he once asked of his white colleagues. "You can't name one member of this court who knew anything about Negroes before he came to the court." His fellow justices knew a great deal more about the impact of race in America after Marshall joined them. Now, we've looked at the justices who joined Earl Warren between 1962 and 1967 because they made up the core of the Warren Court during the years it reshaped American law and society. The court's most liberal members during this period included Justices Hugo Black, William O. Douglas, Earl Warren, Arthur Goldberg, Abe Fortas, and Thurgood Marshall. Justice Brennan was fond of saying, "With five votes, you can do anything around here." And there were at least five votes to support an expansive reading of the Bill of Rights between 1962 and 1969, when Chief Justice Warren and Justice Fortas both left the court. The list of these landmark decisions during these years is long, and the central holdings of most of these rulings are still intact. We've looked at some of these decisions in earlier lectures, cases that dealt with school prayer, the right to counsel for criminal defendants, search and seizure, and protections against self-incrimination. We're going to look now at three of the Warren Court's other landmark decisions. We'll begin with a case that reshaped the American political landscape. The background of this case lies in decades of rural domination of state legislatures. Many state constitutions had provided that each county would have the same number of seats in their legislatures. But as population shifted from farms and small towns to cities and suburbs, the number of voters each lawmaker represented became grossly unequal. For example, the largest state legislative district in Tennessee had 19 voters for each one in the smallest. And in Alabama, the largest senatorial district had 40 times more residents than the smallest. Many state constitutions required periodic reapportionment of legislative districts, but rural lawmakers simply ignored these provisions. The first challenge to unequal representation reached the court in 1946 in a case from Illinois called Colgrove versus Green. But Justice Frankfurter wrote for a majority, holding that state legislative apportionment was a political question and did not raise any constitutional issue. 16 years later, in 1962, Justice Brennan wrote for a new majority of the Warren Court in the case of Baker versus Carr. Six justices voted to reverse the Colgrove decision, granting urban voters in Tennessee the right to challenge their state's unequal apportionment in federal court. Justice Frankfurter, who retired from the court that same year, wrote one of his final dissents in the Baker case, joined by Justice John Harlan. Frankfurter repeated his claim in Colgrove that legislative apportionment was a matter of political controversy and was unfit for federal judicial action. But the Baker ruling prompted a rush to federal courts by urban voters in more than a dozen states. And in 1964, Chief Justice Warren wrote for the court in deciding six of these cases. His opinion in Reynolds v. Sims, which challenged Alabama's unequal districts, included these memorable words: "Legislators represent people, not trees or acres. Legislators are elected by voters, not farms or cities or economic interests." The one-person, one-vote standard of the Reynolds opinion has changed the faces in every state legislature, with urban and suburban lawmakers now controlling those bodies. Black and Hispanic voters in big cities, most of them Democrats, benefited from Warren's ruling. But suburban Republicans have gained even more political clout in recent years. Surprisingly, Chief Justice Warren later said that he considered his Reynolds opinion even more important than his landmark ruling in the Brown case, striking down school segregation. Another segregation case showed the determination of the Warren Court to protect the civil rights of Black Americans. There's a revealing story behind this case. Shortly before the Brown decision in 1954, Chief Justice Warren set off with his Black chauffeur to visit Civil War battlefields in Virginia. He heard echoes of those battles the next morning. Warren emerged from his nice hotel to find that his driver had slept in the car. He asked why. "Well, Mr. Chief Justice," his driver said, "I just couldn't find a place to stay." Warren suddenly realized that nice hotels in Virginia did not admit Black guests. 10 years later, in 1964, Congress passed a sweeping Civil Rights Act that outlawed racial segregation in public accommodations like hotels and restaurants. Congress based the law on its constitutional power to regulate commerce among the several states. As we saw in an earlier lecture, back in 1883, the Supreme Court had struck down a federal civil rights law based on the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And Congress feared the justices might feel bound by that precedent. The owners of the Heart of Atlanta Motel, which filled most of its rooms with out-of-state guests, promptly challenged the new law. The motel's lawyer asked the justices to listen, as he said, to the 43 million white people in the South who believe that a business owner's right to discriminate is more important and more paramount than the commerce of the United States. But Earl Warren listened to the echoing voice of his Black chauffeur. He assigned the court's unanimous opinion to Justice Tom Clark, who wrote in Heart of Atlanta Motel versus the United States that Congress may employ its commerce powers to legislate against what Clark said was the moral and social wrong of racial discrimination. We'll look at one final decision of the Warren Court in this lecture. This case stemmed from national discord over American involvement in the Vietnam War, which sparked massive demonstrations in big cities like Washington and New York. But opposition to the war soon reached the nation's conservative heartland, where protesters often faced hostility from the war's defenders. During the Christmas holiday period in 1965, Senator Robert Kennedy proposed an American bombing halt in Vietnam. A small group of high school students in Des Moines, Iowa, decided to show their support for Kennedy's proposal by wearing black armbands to their classes. One of them was Mary Beth Tinker, a seventh grader at Warren Harding Junior High. School officials got wind of the plan and promptly banned the wearing of armbands. Mary Beth was suspended after she wore her armband in her algebra class. She talked with me later about what happened after newspapers and radio stations covered the armband controversy in Des Moines. "After all the publicity about what we did, we got a lot of repercussions. People threw red paint at our house, and we got lots of calls. We got all kinds of threats to our family, even death threats. They even threatened my little brothers and sisters, which was really sick. I was leaving for school one morning, and the phone rang, and I picked it up. This woman said, 'Is this Mary Tinker?' And I said, 'Yes.' And she said, 'I'm going to kill you.' It's made me a lot more hardened in certain ways when you learn in a personal way what the repercussions are for doing unpopular things." Mary Beth and other students who had been suspended asked a federal judge to overturn the armband regulation as a violation of their First Amendment rights. The judge ruled against them, and they appealed to the Supreme Court. We're going to listen now to brief excerpts of the oral arguments in Tinker versus Des Moines. Dan Johnston, a young lawyer for the American Civil Liberties Union, argues for the students. He tells the justices that the armband protest was entirely peaceful.
"The difficulty we have with this particular policy, as it was enacted, is that there was no indication, no testimony by teachers, by administrators, or anyone else, of any reason to believe that it would be disruptive. And when the students, in fact, did wear the armbands, the record quite clearly shows that it was not, in fact, disruptive.
Chief Justice Warren is troubled by the prospect of disruption in the schools, and he pushes Johnston on this issue.
I suppose you would concede that if it started fistfights or something of that kind and disrupted the school, that the principal could prevent the use of them.
The suggestion I believe we're making, Your Honor, is that there should not be any special rule for freedom of expression cases for schools.
Johnston concedes that school officials have the right to deal with disruptive activities, but he repeats his argument that schools are not exempt from the First Amendment.
I should not think that there would have to be a special rule for schools or any other part of our society for the First Amendment. Now, the evidence of disruption might be different, but as far as the principles applied, we'd like to have the same principles applied in the school, or perhaps especially in the school, that are applied elsewhere.
Alan Herrick argues for the Des Moines School Board. He's some 40 years older than Dan Johnston, and he voices the sentiments of his generation.
Now, in substance, if we understand the petitioner's position in this case, it is that the school officials are powerless to act until the disruption occurs. Respondents believe that should not be the rule. Sometimes a ounce of prevention is a lot better than a pound of cure, and I think subsequent history of such activities bear out the judgment of the school officials and their discretion.
When the court decided the Tinker case, seven justices sided with the students, and only two backed the school board. Justice Abe Fortas wrote for the majority and put his views in these words: First Amendment rights, applied in light of the special characteristics of the school environment, are available to teachers and students. It can hardly be argued that either students or teachers shed their constitutional rights to freedom of speech or expression at the schoolhouse gate. Fortas used strong words in his opinion. In our system, state-operated schools may not be enclaves of totalitarianism. School officials do not possess absolute authority over their students. They are possessed of fundamental rights which the state must respect, just as they themselves must respect their obligations to the state. The court's oldest member, Hugo Black, was known for his absolute defense of the First Amendment, but he dissented in the Tinker case, along with the next oldest justice, John Harlan. Black endorsed what he called the old-fashioned slogan, that children are to be seen, not heard. He warned that the court's approval of armbands marked the beginning of a new revolutionary era of permissiveness in this country. Black ended his dissent with these words: "This case, wholly without constitutional reasons in my judgment, subjects all the public schools in the country to the whims and caprices of their loudest mouthed, but maybe not their brightest students." Mary Beth Tinker is still proud of her stand in junior high. She now works as a nurse in a Veterans Administration hospital, and her patients include many Vietnam veterans. And she's still a peace activist. "I'm really proud we had a part in ending the crazy Vietnam War," she told me. The Supreme Court handed down its Tinker decision in March of 1969. This was one of the last rulings of the Warren Court. But the era of the Warren Court had already ended. The year before, in June of 1968, Earl Warren had announced his intention to retire after the Senate confirmed his successor. 2 months after the Tinker decision, President Richard Nixon nominated Warren Earl Burger as the next Chief Justice. In our next lecture, we'll look at the complicated and confusing story of Warren's retirement and Burger's nomination to replace him. This episode in the court's history illustrates the impact of political factors on the shape of constitutional law.